Between the flame out of punk music in the 1970s and the ascent of grunge in the 1990s, there was the music of the indie scene. Hardcore, sometimes called. The angry, thumping, sometimes pointedly numbing music of bands that defied the major music labels and found their own audience on the outskirts of the industry. Independent bands who mainlined their own music into the veins of an audience that resented the rise of baby boomer culture and the way it had captured so-called popular music. Bands like Husker Du, Butthole Surfers, Beat Happening, and Black Flag. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Black Flag's Rise Above. Michael Azarad tells the stories of 13 such groups in his book, Our Band Could Be Your Life. Scenes from the American Indie Underground, 1981 to 1991, and he joins us here in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here, Scott.
You consider this an important work.
That song in particular, I mean, really encapsulates a lot. It's got that, as you can hear, the incredibly raw feeling. And yet, it's got that refrain of rise above, you know, transcend all the adversity around you. Mm-hmm. The people who were listening to this music were, you know, kind of outsiders, angry people who, you know, felt disenfranchised from any number of aspects of society. So this idea of rise above was also incredibly inspirational, even while the music was so angry. And I think that song really encapsulates that feeling of community and comfort that you could actually get from such abrasive music.
I'm interested when you talk about the music of outsiders, because, I mean, this was the Southern California band, and the people you're talking about weren't often defined as outsiders. I mean, there they were in the middle of this extraordinary megaplex, most of them people we would consider middle class.
I think they feel like outsiders because they're not buying into that homogenized, mediocre, middle-class existence that was, you know, so incredibly typified by Southern California at the time. And after a while, especially if you're an adolescent or late adolescent, you're really feeling your oats and, you know, it can really drive you bonkers. And there were really a lot of kids who felt that way. And most of them wound up being hardcore punks.
These bands understood that there was nothing magical about finding a major label recording studio. They could just more or less do what they wanted to do and trusted they could find an audience.
Yeah, it was kind of this quantum leap that people discovered that you could not only enter a recording studio by yourself, but you could actually mount a tour and make your own record label. And this put them outside of that mainstream major label scene. And that was a very radical notion at the time. Rock music was very mystified. People who made rock music were a breed apart. But punk rock came along and said, anyone can do it.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some idea of the economics that were involved in keeping an indie group together?
Mm. You didn't really make any money off selling records because you didn't sell any records. Some of the best-selling albums of that time were like 5,000 copies, and compare that with something like Britney Spears, who probably sells 10 or 15 million. So you made your money, what money you did, from touring, and maybe you sold a T-shirt or two. But basically, these bands were living on $5 a day. For instance, there was the Butthole Surfers, who half of this band had degrees in accounting, and they had actually begun to work at these prestigious accounting firms, and at one point found themselves scrambling on the streets of the East Village in New York, trying to get returnable bottles so they could eat.
On the other hand, I guess they'd know how to make that a tax write-off, wouldn't they? Let me ask you next about Husker Du, and we want to listen to their song Celebrated Summer, 1984.
You'll notice there's that same similar abrasiveness that Black Flag had, but there's a little bit of tunefulness in there. You can actually kind of, there's a melody to it.
Yeah. And how did that happen, for goodness sakes?
Well, you know, it really came down to people who had grown up on the Beatles. Those Husker Du guys actually just liked melody. So these bands were starting to acknowledge the music that they'd grown up on. They were starting to desist from making music that had no history at all as a reaction against this mainstream onslaught, and they were actually starting to come around to something that reflected their roots. And with more melody attracted a different audience, too. It wasn't just these kind of alienated thugs anymore. It was starting to be college students, people a bit more, shall we say, sensitive.
Husker Du even got a major label contract, didn't he?
Yeah, Husker Du was the first really big indie band to get a major label deal, and it really sent shockwaves through the community because the whole thing was predicated on the idea that this stuff would never break through to the mainstream, and there was a certain degree of comfort in that. And when a band like Husker Du made that big break, the Pandora's box had been opened.
I'm interested in some of the stage aspects of some of the indie bands. What did they wear, for example? Now, this was at a time when mainstream rock was becoming almost operatic sometimes in its stage presentations.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, by the mid-80s, MTV was a huge dominant force, and you had people like Prince in all his finery and Madonna in, in all her glory. And yet at the same time, you had these bands wearing flannel shirts and ripped jeans, and that was definitely a reaction, you know, against what was going on in the mainstream.
In its own way, did the flannel shirts, the ripped jeans, become its own kind of costume?
It absolutely did. A lot of the aspects of the scene were started out of necessity and then became a style. For instance, you know, the poor recording technique. It started because no one knew how to record and they had really bad equipment. And after a while, it stayed that way because it was a badge of authenticity. Yeah. When in fact, a lot of times they could have done better.
Let me ask you about Beat Happening's a 1988 song called Indian Summer. Now, this is from the, I guess we can now refer to it historically as the latter end of the indie movement.
Sure.
Let's listen in.
What is that cheerful sound? Rain falling on the ground. We'll wear a jolly crown. Buckle up, we're wayward bound. We'll come back for Indian Summer. We'll come back for Indian Summer. We'll come back for Indian Summer. Then go a separate way.
Now, is this a wistful indie version of See You in September?
I think you've actually just completely hit it right on the head. But, I mean, the amazing thing about that song is it's bone simple. It's got like two chords, you know, the playing is absolutely rudimentary. The guy can barely sing, you know, technically speaking, and yet it's incredibly evocative. And for me, that song is such a great argument for that whole do-it-yourself, or they abbreviated it to DIY, sentiment that anyone can do it. If you've got a little inspiration and some motivation to actually put it down on tape.
I guess I'm interested in what some of these artists are going to bring to the future of music now.
Oh, I mean, the legacy of these bands is maybe bigger than we think. When I saw the uprising in Seattle, I mean, I thought of all these bands who really preached against going with the received political wisdom, the received cultural wisdom. There was this idea that music was perhaps a metaphor for a lot of other things. You know, that's why I called the book Our Band Could Be Your Life, because you could look at the way a band like the Minutemen conducted their career and apply it to your life, whether you were a bricklayer or a car salesman, anything. You could be pragmatic and frugal and do things your own way without being told by some media conglomerate in Los Angeles or New York how to do it.
Mr. Azarat, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Scott.
Michael Azarat, his new book is Our Band Could Be Your Life, Scenes from the American Indie Underground, 1981 to 1991, published by Little Brown.